How's everybody doing? Welcome back to another episode of The Banker Next Door. This is the Lords of Easy Money series. We are continuing today with part 10, and we're going to cover chapter 8 of the book. And I'm wearing my little shirt here. It just says Stonier shirt. It's kind of this is kind of the unofficial Stonier weekend. The official Stonier weekend will be the week of June 9th through the 12th, I think, this year, coming up in June very soon. But if you have a chance, check out the interview that I did with Greg Smith, who is the curriculum director at Stonier. And then I'll be also posting some other stuff in the weekly update. But let's jump right in here to our book on chapter 8. So today we are doing chapter 8, which is The Fixer. And we are going to be covering the period of 1971 through 2014. Now, this is the chapter we're going to be covering Jeremy Powell and his background tonight, but we're also going to be covering how the ZERP, the zero interest rate policy and quantitative easing, how we're going to start to see the nuts and bolts of this starting with this chapter. Up to this point, we've talked about the Fed's policies and what the Fed has done, but we haven't really gotten into the real depths of like how did this ultimately influence and affect the overall economy. And we talked about asset inflation and price inflation, and we've talked about a lot of the different mechanisms and things that have gone on there. But now we're going to see, starting with this chapter here, how did this really push and drive the economy and change the financial markets in very different ways, starting with private equity companies. So with that being said, let's jump right in here. So Jay Powell was a senior in high school. His classmates included a future congressman and Panama's future ambassador to the United States. Other students from Georgetown Preparatory School became U.S. senators, lobbyists, federal judges, and senior corporate executives. Two future Supreme Court judges, Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh, graduated from Georgetown Prep in the mid-1980s. The Georgetown Prep campus was near Powell's childhood home in Chevy Chase, a suburb of Washington, D.C. That's along the Beltway there by Silver Springs and kind of on the Maryland side. The streets of Chevy Chase were lined with majestic oak trees, and the stately houses were set back behind wide, lush lawns. Powell was one of six children in a large Catholic family. He was named after his father, a prominent corporate attorney who had argued in front of the Supreme Court. Powell's mother, Patricia, earned her master's degree in liberal arts from George Washington University and was a well-known volunteer around Chevy Chase, who also worked part-time for the Republican National Committee. The family belonged to the Chevy Chase Club, along with an exclusive dining establishment in Washington called the Soulgrave Club. Now, the curriculum at Georgetown Prep was rigorous, but a lot of the real education happened between classes, and it taught lessons that were impossible to replicate elsewhere. At Georgetown Prep, a person learned how to be around the most powerful people in the world. The savvy students would have picked up on a million unspoken cues and subtle rules of etiquette that govern interactions of the very rich and influential. It is difficult to even quantify this code of conduct. A person needs to live it. Now, I can speak to this because my father was born and raised in Chevy Chase. He lived not far from where Jeremy Powell went to. He went to St. John's College High School, which is not far from Georgetown Prep. And so having my father grow up there, his family grew up there. My father was one of five and also a very Catholic family. So I very much can relate to the story here and what's going on here in terms of how they're talking about the lessons of power and how he was around people that would become prominent people in the future, and that there's just these subtle kind of lessons and things that have to do with, you know, some rules and etiquette of kind of the DC establishment, if you will. So I promise you, I say this, that all this stuff that he's talking about is very real. That's the point of what I'm trying to tell you. Okay, so now let's move in to Jay Powell. It's a little bit more of adult life. So as an adult, Jay Powell knew how to operate at the center of things. He could spend almost his entire career at a very specific spot at the pinnacle of American power, the intersection of public government and private money. He occupied the offices that connected the worlds of Washington and Wall Street. He was a fixer who helped things operate smoothly between big capital and big government, and he developed a good reputation in this rarefied world. Powell was a man of discretion and good judgment. He was solid, but he was never a prime mover in the halls of power, never an elected official or a CEO. He was impeccable at his job. While never famous, he was nonetheless deeply respected in the circles that really mattered. It was fitting that when Powell was eventually appointed chairman of the Fed in 2018, his selection generated almost no controversy. He was seen above all things as being an effective operator. Powell had been a Federal Reserve governor for roughly 5 years at that point and had engaged in some of the thorniest, most complicated debates about Fed policy. He's a pragmatist who will pursue an economic good and turn a deaf ear to politics, one person said. Powell never turned a deaf ear to politics. He would often be described as a lawyer because he had earned a law degree, but his career was far more varied than that. After he graduated high school in 1971, Powell enrolled at Princeton. After graduation, he became a legislative staffer on Capitol Hill and then went to law school at Georgetown University, earning his degree and then clerking with a federal appeals court judge in New York. Powell followed his father's footsteps and became a corporate attorney, joining the firm Davis, Polk & Wardell. In 1984, however, at the age of 31, Powell made a consequential move. He left the world of law and joined the world of investment banking. Powell was hired at a firm called Dillon, Reed & Company. This was where he'd begin his long path toward great wealth in the world of corporate debt. Now, at this point, I think it is very important to point out the difference between Jeremy Powell and some of his predecessors at the Fed. When you look at Alan Greenspan, when you look at Paul Volcker, when you look at Ben Bernanke, these were all highly decorated PhD economists, you know, very steeped in academia. The, you know, guys that, you know, had written papers, really understood the economy inside and out. And Jeremy Powell couldn't be further from that. You know, Powell was an attorney. I would describe him as a very political animal, as a kind of Washington animal. Like he knew how to operate within the sphere of Washington, like it said, between Washington and Wall Street. That was his background. That was his thing. Now, we're going to see in a minute here, he did some very good things in his career and had some really good experiences. But I want you to just keep this question in mind. Is he the guy that we've needed running the Fed, you know, for the last, 5 years now? And I just want everybody to keep that question in mind, because I think that question is going to answer itself over time here, but we'll see. When journalists describe Dillon, Reed & Company, they almost inevitably use terms like white shoe, elite, and exclusive. The company had been around in one form or another since the 1800s. Partners at Dillon, Red were the relentlessly effective servants of big money. It might seem odd that a lawyer like Powell would join an investment firm, but the transition from corporate law to high finance is common because lawyers can handle the thorny, wildly complicated contracts that make big money deals possible. A background in law trained someone like Jay Powell and a key skill set necessary for success at Dillon Reed, discretion. The corporate culture was very private, recalled Catherine Austin Fitz, who was a managing director at the firm. The reasons for discretion were strategic. Big companies worked with Dillon Reed because they trusted its partners to stay quiet, maybe for months at a stretch, as they helped negotiate the deal. The other key attribute to success at Dillon Reed was loyalty. The company built long-standing relationships with its clients that endured years, if not decades. Fitz said that the partners at Dillon Reed were like members of the Hanseatic League, a guild of merchants who operated in Northern Europe during the 1300s. Their tagline was serious business with long-term partners, which is a perfect description of Dillon Reed. Dillon Reed focused on deals that were profitable, but not flashy. The firm dealt with energy companies, manufacturers, and city infrastructure departments. This was tedious, highly profitable work that required a certain creativity in realms of life that people believe to be lethal to creative minds, like accounting, bond repayment scheduling, and the writing of loan covenants. If a person operated effectively in this space, the payouts were enormous. By all indications, Powell thrived in the environment. So, I will say there's a lot of truth to what they were saying. Like somebody who, you know, kind of shifted from corporate law to high finance. There's a lot of truth in that. I mean, it actually is a very good fit because, you know, as a lawyer, he's just trained in certain skills in writing contracts and contract negotiation that just kind of fit perfectly into that world of high finance, because you have to be able to, you need somebody with those skills in order to be able to get those kind of deals done and completed that they were working on. So this does, you know, again, a lot of this so far so good does make sense to how Powell's career trajectory went. So Powell would have learned at Dillon Reed about the granular mechanics of issuing corporate debt. This form of debt came to play a central role in American economic life during the decade of quantitative easing and ZERP. When Powell warned in 2013 that loan values were being inflated and might crash, he was talking about corporate debt. His warnings reflected his deep knowledge about a corner of the financial world that was once dominated by elite firms like Dillon Reed, because he helped create and sell corporate debt for so many years. Powell would have understood that the debt was structured in a strange way that eventually made it a profound danger to the global financial system. There are two basic kinds of corporate debt, a corporate bond and a leveraged loan. A corporate bond is in many ways like any typical bank loan. A company might borrow $1 million by issuing a bond, and the bond will carry an interest rate of 5%. The bond has a lifespan like a 30-year home loan, at the end of which it must all be paid back. But this is where the similarities end. Corporate bonds have a strange structure that's different from credit card debt or a car loan. With a corporate bond, the company only makes interest payments during the lifespan of the loan and then pays off the entire debt on the day the loan expires. So the loan doesn't get gradually paid down over the years like a mortgage. In other words, it's not amortizing. The open secret, however, about corporate bonds is that the companies almost never intend to actually pay them off. Instead, they usually roll the loan, meaning they hire a bank to sell the debt before it comes due and then replace it with a new loan. I want you to remember that word roll. When you hear, you're going to hear this phrase, rolling the debt. I've probably heard that, you know, 1,000 times on CNBC and Bloomberg over the last, you know, 4 or 5 months. But just keep that in mind, because you're going to hear that a lot. And you're going to hear it a lot for the rest of the year. So now the bonds expire, but the debt survives and is rolled into a new bond that the company will later sell and roll again. So it just keeps rolling and rolling. Companies continually roll over corporate debt for years. This is what leaves them exposed to risk. If interest rates are rising when it comes time to roll the loan, companies can be in deep trouble. Ah, really? That sounds familiar. They face two bad choices. They could pay off the entire debt at one time, or they can roll over the debt into a bond that has a higher interest rate and is therefore more expensive. In spite of this risk, there is a vigorous market where corporate bonds are bought and sold. The bonds are standardized and regulated by the Securities and Exchange Commission, just like shares of stock. The price of a bond can go up and down just like a stock. A bond price is usually expressed in terms of how likely the borrower is to repay. A good bond might be trading at 95 cents on the dollar, meaning there is an expectation that the bond will be paid back nearly in full. The interest rates are regular, providing great cash flow for whoever owns the bond. The riskier a bond is, the higher the interest rate it pays to compensate for the danger that the borrower might default. A big safe borrower like Walmart pays a low rate, while smaller companies with a lot of debt pay a higher rate. The riskiest corporate bonds are the ones called junk bonds. Now, the other type of corporate debt is called a leveraged loan. This is like a corporate bond in some ways. A leveraged loan is bought and sold, and it carries an interest rate that reflects its risk. The key difference is that leveraged loans are more tailored. They tend to be extended directly from a bank to a company, and they aren't standardized in the same way that bonds are. Firms like Dillon Reed used corporate bonds and leveraged loans as rocket fuel to propel corporate takeovers, mergers, and acquisitions. Now you're beginning to see the debt. The debt comes in, and now the companies, law firms like Dillon Reed, they're using corporate bonds and leveraged loans as rocket fuel to propel corporate takeovers, mergers, and acquisitions. So now we're going to get into how Powell makes a move to the Treasury. So Powell did well at Dillon Reed, but his education in corporate debt was interrupted before he could earn the kind of fortune that drew corporate lawyers to Wall Street. In 1988, the company's chairman, Nicholas Brady, was recruited by Ronald Reagan to become Secretary of the Treasury. After George H.W. Bush was elected president and Brady's job security was insured, Powell left Dillon Reed to join Brady at the Treasury. Brady's trust in Powell would be validated almost immediately after Powell arrived in Washington, D.C. A scandal erupted inside the Treasury Department involving financial fraud, risky derivative contracts, and a too-big-to-fail Wall Street investment house. Powell was called upon to help fix the mess, and it provided him with the next phase of his education in the ways of power in Washington, D.C. So now we're going to get into the fiasco in the early 90s with Salomon Brothers. And for those who don't know, Salomon Brothers ended up merging with Smith Barney to become Salomon Smith Barney. And then they ended up getting bought out by J.P. Morgan. I believe that's correct. Yeah, I believe it was J.P. Morgan that bought them out. But Salomon Brothers back in the early 90s was a major Wall Street investment firm. And we're going to see the shenanigans that went on there. So Powell was assistant Treasury Secretary for Domestic Finance, a job that put him in charge of issuing the government's debt. This division was one that actually issued U.S. Treasury bonds. In some ways, the job was mundane and predictable, sort of like running a printing press. The U.S. debt system was well-established and well-run, so Powell's job was like that of a station manager who had to make sure the trains moved smoothly through a busy station. His department worked closely with the New York Federal Reserve Bank, which auctioned off the Treasury bills to the primary dealers on Wall Street. In February 1991, the traders at the New York Fed reported something odd. There were two companies that were involved in buying and selling treasuries. If these two companies were buying treasury bonds on behalf of their common owner, meaning that both companies were owned by the same company, that would be illegal. The government put restrictions on how many treasury bonds any single company could buy so that nobody could corner the market. The trades looked fishy, raising suspicion that a big bank might be trying to sneak around the limits by purchasing treasury bills through seemingly separate shell companies. The common owner of the firms was the primary dealer, Salomon Brothers. So a letter got sent over to Salomon asking, hey, what's going on here? So inside Salomon Brothers, this letter was quickly conveyed to Paul Moser, the bond trader who oversaw the firm's treasury bill purchases. Moser came clean to his bosses very quickly, admitting that he had been running a scam using affiliate companies to buy enough treasuries that the firm could quietly amass more than the 35% of all the treasury bonds sold in a given auction, the limit imposed by law. The goal was to get so many treasuries that Salomon could then put the squeeze on other firms that bought the bills in a secondary market. There was no gray area here. It was a criminal scheme. But Moser wasn't fired, and Salomon covered up his behavior. The company sent a letter back to the Treasury Department explaining that the suspicious purchases were an innocent mistake. Moser continued the scheme. He continued the scheme, cornering the market and squeezing competitors. In May of 1991, Salomon used the scam to buy so many treasury bills that it controlled 94% of the supply. The Treasury Department, meanwhile, seemed entirely content with Salomon's explanation that nothing was amiss. Powell's boss, Secretary Nicholas Brady, happened to be good friends with Steve Bell, the managing director of Salomon Brothers' office in Washington, D.C. Bell wasn't a bond trader. He was one of those people who had worked in Washington for years and seemed to know everyone. One of Bell's greatest achievements back when he was a Senate staffer was helping the Reagan administrator create a novel administrative maneuver called reconciliation, which allowed the president to pass a budget through the Senate with a bare majority of votes, bypassing the filibuster. Reconciliation was later used to pass Obamacare and the Trump tax cuts. earning Bell a level of notoriety on the Hill, a fact that he advertised decades later with pride. Bell's Salmon Brothers office was located in the Willard Hotel just across the street from the Treasury Building, literally right across the street. Salmon's big rigging became public after the May 22nd auction, when Salmon bought so many treasuries that it controlled 94% of the market. The conduct was simply too egregious to go unnoticed. This time, regulators from the Securities and Exchange Commission and the Federal Reserve didn't take Salmon's word that nothing was amiss. It quickly became clear that the big rigging would almost certainly result in criminal charges and massive fines. But even more dangerous for Salmon was the chance that the Department of the Treasury might revoke Salmon's designation as a primary dealer. Without that designation, the firm would go bankrupt. It was an existential threat, Bell said. There was one person who helped ensure that this threat was not realized, Bell believed, and it was Jay Powell. When the big rigging was exposed, Salmon's CEO stepped down and was replaced by one of the firm's biggest stakeholders, the Omaha investor, Warren Buffett. Oh, man, Warren was all over this one. Didn't want to lose that investment. Buffett immediately admitted that the firm was guilty and prohibited Bell's team from hiring the kind of high-priced DC legal firm that might be able to wage a war against the SEC and the Treasury. Buffett came to Washington, set up shop in Bell's office kitchen, and got on the phone to start negotiating with the Treasury Department over Salmon's survival. The person on the other end of the phone line was Jay Powell. Buffett delivered a simple message. He would help clean up Salmon, but he needed the Treasury to show forbearance. Buffett said, "I will take on this task, but not if you make it impossible for us to survive," Bell said. Nicholas Brady still suspended Salmon's status as a primary dealer, a death sentence in Bell's eyes. He believed that if the company was allowed to die, it would take down other Wall Street firms with it, and his message was simple. What if you knock down the biggest tree and it collapses and knocks down a lot of other trees in the forest, Bell said. I think he knew that there would be some substantial disruption of global markets given the huge position that Salmon had in derivatives and other instruments. Jay knew markets very well. He had been with Brady earlier, and he had the trust of the secretary. So now we have Warren Buffett called Brady directly to plead Salmon's case, and the Treasury Department soon reversed its decision and reinstated Salmon's designation as a primary dealer. Bell would always credit Jay Powell with the victory and with keeping Salmon alive. I know that Jay was critical in informing Secretary Brady's decision, Bell said. The ruling gave Buffett time to pursue his cleanup plan for the company. So in this little mini saga within this chapter, I mean, there's so much to unpack here. You have Salmon Brothers, who has a guy clearly doing something illegal, trying to corner the Treasury market. He gets caught. He admits this to his bosses, but his bosses literally love the scheme so much and see the potential to make so much money doing this that they're basically just look the other way and just say, hey, it's all cool, man. You just keep right on doing it. He's able, the Treasury just, you know, turns a blind eye to the whole thing and basically just says, they told us, wink, wink, everything was fine. So we're totally cool with that. And these guys basically just pig out, just become total disgusting, greedy pigs. And just go and just corner the whole market, buy up 94% of all the treasuries. And this becomes so blatant and so egregious, and it blows up in their face that everybody's all over this and they can't hide it. And now it all comes out. And Salmon Brothers should have been buried. They should have been absolutely buried. But instead, who comes to save the day? Jeremy Powell and Warren Buffett come in, you know, because Warren Buffett, heaven forbid, Warren Buffett lose his investment in something. You know, Wall Street and governments always seem to step in. We always hear about how great Warren Buffett is, but yet he always seems to have enough leverage in these situations to get powerful people in D.C. and Washington and Wall Street to bail him out. Anyway, that's a story for another time. But Jeremy Powell, and this story is so important. Because what it shows you is that how much of a political animal that Jeremy Powell is, and how he is willing to play ball, and he's willing to do whatever it takes to bail out the big boys at the expense of everybody else. Forget the fact that that Salmon tried to screw everyone in the market. Forget the fact they tried to manipulate the U.S. Treasury's market. Forget all that. We can't have them go down because, God forbid, you know, a bunch of these Wall Street guys should get hammered. So again, this is very telling of the way that Jeremy Powell is. And as we go through the rest of the book, this example here is going to show itself out. So let's continue on here. So now we're going to get into Powell actually be called to testify on Capitol Hill. But the bigger problem that worried Powell, powerful members of Congress was the regulatory fiasco that had allowed Salmon to cheat in the first place and to continue cheating even after its trades first raised suspicion. The House of Representatives held a public hearing on the matter in September. It was revealing who the Treasury Department sent to testify. While the SEC had sent its chairman and the New York Fed sent its president, Nick Brady sent Powell to testify on his behalf. Powell was the designated target for incoming fire. Like, in other words, Brady wanted no part of that. He was going to send Powell to take the beating. And he was brutalized by the lawmakers. Press accounts of the hearing used words like assailed and interrogated. But Powell never seemed to get agitated. The Treasury had failed to detect Salmon's scheme and allowed it to continue. But Powell managed to explain everything in such a bloodless way that it seemed to drain the passion of his inquisitors. After the hearings, Powell oversaw the writing of a lengthy report on the scandal and the role of the regulators who enabled it. Ultimately, very little changed. Shocking. The Treasury Department amended the way Treasury auctions were conducted, moving to the Dutch auction style, which was seen as harder to game. Moser was convicted and sent to prison. Salmon's CEO, John Gutfreund, was fined $100,000. Powell was promoted. He became Undersecretary of the Treasury at the age of 39. His tenure in that role was cut short, however, when George H.W. Bush lost his reelection bid. So he was hired to become a partner then at Carlyle Group. And we're going to get into Carlyle Group here right now as we go through here. But again, Jeremy Powell impressed a lot of people with his testimony here in this situation because he was able to take a lot of flack. He was able to stay cool under fire. But I think the most important thing there was that, you know, he managed to explain everything in such a bloodless way that it seemed to drain the passion of his inquisitors. I think it's fair to say that he basically has done that for the last 4 or 5 years as head of the Fed. So it's something that he is very adept at. Okay, so leveraging the connections and influence of Washington insiders was the core of Carlyle Group's extremely successful business strategy. The company was co-founded in 1987 by David Rubenstein, a former staffer to Jimmy Carter, who said the company's location in the Naples nation's capital was what gave it an advantage over the other 250 private equity firms that were in business then, most of them in New York. Carlyle specialized in buying and selling businesses that relied on government spending, and it hired former government officials to help. In 2001 alone, Carlyle hired the former chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, the former chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, and the former chief investment officer of the World Bank. These people helped steer deals to Carlyle, and Carlyle helped these people monetize their granular knowledge and personal connections in the industries they once regulated. So again, you see that the revolving door between Wall Street and Washington, D.C., and just, you know, high finance and politics just rolling. The Carlyle Group, like other private equity firms, went out and raised money from wealthy people and institutional investors like pension funds that put big chunks of money into a pool of cash that Carlyle would use to buy companies. The basic goal was to invest, improve, and sell those smaller companies. Carlyle typically held onto a company for about 5 years and then sold it, ideally for a profit. Debt was key to this business model. The pool of investment money was always supercharged by leveraged loans and corporate bonds. Carlyle would put up some of its own cash, then borrow much more to fund the deal. Importantly, the debt was loaded into the company that Carlyle bought. Then that company had to work hard to pay the loan off. It was like being able to buy a house that earned cash and paid off its own mortgage. The key quality for a successful partner at Carlyle was to be connected. The ideal Carlyle partner had to know the right people in government agencies. They also had to know the right bankers who could arrange and syndicate massive amounts of leveraged loans. And they had to know talented people to bring in and help run the companies they bought in order to get them ready in a matter of years to sell. Powell joined Carlyle in 1997 when he was in his mid-40s. His office was on the second floor of Carlyle's headquarters building on Pennsylvania Avenue, not too far from the White House. The Carlyle offices were hardly lavish by the standards of private equity. Wall Street firms often decorated their spaces with hardwood finishes and fine art hanging on the wall. The aesthetic at Carlyle was utilitarian. The company hung prints instead of original paintings, and the partners met in stripped-down conference rooms that could have been found in any law firm or insurance office. The partners kept their focus on the market, and the market returned the favor. The parade of banks came to Carlyle to advertise companies that were for sale. It was the job of people like Powell to sift through the offerings, like flipping through the pages of a catalog, seeking out deals with the most potential. In 2002, one deal caught Jeremy Powell's attention. An industrial conglomerate called Rexnord, based in Milwaukee, was looking for a new owner. Rexnord made expensive high-precision equipment that was used in heavy industry like specialty ball bearings and conveyor belts. The company had been owned by a string of investors since the late 1980s, each one loading the firm with more debt and then handing it off to the next, hoping to reap a profit. Even after this treadmill of debt and resale, the firm remained attractive. It produced the one thing that private equity partners valued above all, a steady cash flow. This meant the company was in a good position to pay down the debt that would be loaded onto it. Jeremy Powell put together a team to manage the acquisition and helped arrange the financing to make it happen. Carlyle would invest $359.5 million of its own money from its buyout fund, using this cash as a down payment. Powell helped secure two loans worth a total of $585 million to pay for the rest of the purchase price. This acquisition would mark the pinnacle of Jay Powell's private equity career. It also provided him with a firsthand education in the issues and risks of corporate debt. Rexnord's headquarters were located in an unremarkable two-story brick building next to a big parking lot in mid-central Milwaukee. Behind the main office building was one of the company's factories and a tall smokestack that had chain belt stenciled down its side in white lettering, a nod to the company's original name, which dated back to the late 1800s. The name Rexnord was born about 100 years later after one of many mergers. The facility was surrounded by working-class neighborhoods of modest houses. So we're going to get a little bit more into Rexnord here in just a second, but I wanted to stop. So Carlyle Group, you know, one of the largest and most powerful private equity firms, you know, Jeremy Powell comes to work there, and now he's following the private equity model, which is basically buy a company, load it up with debt, hold on to that thing for 5 years, try to, you know, use that debt to grow the company. And then after you grow that company over the course of 5 years and then try to dump it and try to make yourself a 20%+ return, that will return a lot of money to not only the Carlyle Group company and the shareholders, but the individuals like Jeremy Powell involved in these transactions. So just, you know, I'm just trying to go over and lay the groundwork for how this thing kind of works. And that's a very high level cursory overview. But again, I just want to kind of keep you up to speed as to like what's happening here. So, okay, now we're going to get into Tom Jensen, okay, who's a worker at Rexnord. So Tom Jensen started working at Rexnord in the 1980s in the accounting department. After several promotions over many years, he became the chief financial officer, a job title that understated his level of responsibility. Many CFOs are in charge of a company's financial affairs, but Jensen was also in charge of shaping and reshaping the entire firm as it repeatedly changed hands starting in the late 1980s. Jensen's work was grueling. There was something exciting, though, about being Rexnord's CFO in a world of private equity. The company had become a case study in the debt-fueled model of American capitalism under private equity. One of the early buyout kings named Jeffrey Steiner bought Rexnord with junk bond debt, cut costs at the firm, then sold it off in the mid-1990s in a deal that paid him $6.3 million. Rexnord continued to change hands after that. After one acquisition, Tom was asked to help rebuild the company, and in doing so became close with the next CEO named Robert Hitt. Jensen and Hitt created a roadshow that advertised the virtues of Rexnord as a corporate property. They hired investment bankers to spread the word among private equity owners, and soon they were making their pitch to a parade of speculators who traveled to Milwaukee. There's a whole variety of people that come to kick the tires. There's bottom feeders that you could tell right away, Jensen recalled. The bottom feeders wanted to buy Rexnord, strip it down, and sell off the pieces for a quick profit. The bottom feeders made Jay Powell and the team from Carlyle stand out. The Carlyle team was cool, calm, and exuded the kind of confidence that comes from big money. So just a couple quick hints on that. So I kind of laughed at when he said bottom feeders. And they wanted to buy Rexnord, and they wanted to strip it down and sell the pieces for a quick profit. Well, if anybody remembers the movie Pretty Woman and Richard Gere, this is exactly what Richard Gere did in the movies. He was a private equity guy. He would buy a company. He'd buy a company because the sum of its parts were more valuable than the whole. So he'd buy a company, strip it down, sell off the different pieces, make a ton of money, and then just go and repeat the process. So if that helps anybody kind of envision what, you know, what's going on here, but I find it amusing that he uses the term bottom feeders, because I'm sure there are, bottom feeders out there. But and then just another note, you know, it said that, you know, Jansen and Hitt put together a roadshow. Roadshow is a very typical term in corporate America for when, you know, you're trying to either, if you're trying to raise money or you're trying to sell the company, you know, you might put together this show and they call it a roadshow, and you might actually go on the road and go around and visit different people, try to get them to buy your business or try to raise money, whatever the case may be. So, okay, but let's continue on here. So, but there was real money in Rexnord's product lines of highly engineered conveyor belts and specialized ball bearings that were used in airplanes. It made things that people needed to make the world move, Jensen explained. Rexnord's business model was like the one used by razor blade companies. The razor was cheap. The replacement blades were expensive and very profitable. Rexnord made its real money selling replacement parts when the vital important conveyor belts broke down or the expensive ball bearings wore out. The company's annual sales were reliable at about $755 million a year. It earned more than $113 million a year in profit before taxes and interest payments. Jeremy Powell and his team were sold. To Jensen's surprise, Powell turned the tables and started pitching the Rexnord team on the benefits of being owned by the Carlyle Group. The pitch was, "We want to help you. We want to help you grow," Jensen recalled. The team from Carlyle promised that they wouldn't micromanage. Carlyle would place its people on Rexnord's board of directors, where they would steer the company, but they'd give the local management team autonomy. Yeah, right. Quick lesson in high finance with private equity firms. Like, yes, when they buy your company, they're going to put a representative on the board of the company to oversee and watch everything that's going on. I think a lot of times than not, they will claim that they will give you autonomy. Is this the case? No, it's not. They may give you leeway. And again, in other words, they don't want to actually run the day-to-day. So they're going to leave you do the day-to-day, okay? However, when it comes to any big decision, okay, they're going to be right in the middle of it, and you're going to have to go back and get their blessing before you do anything, okay? So understand that. So anyway, okay. The debt put pressure on Rexnord. In the early 2003, Rexnord employees in Milwaukee agreed to take an average pay cut of $3 an hour, along with other concessions, to convince the management team not to move 70 jobs to North Carolina. The Milwaukee employees were unionized, and so moving those jobs to a non-unionized southern state might have saved Rexnord money, but Jansen said the Carlyle team was sensitive about the headlines such an action might create. So they definitely did not want to do that. After Powell joined Rexnord's board of directors, he often traveled to Milwaukee to meet with Jensen and the rest of the management team. Holding long meetings about the company's strategy, budget, and operations, they didn't gather for these meetings at Rexnord's actual headquarters near the factory. Instead, they rented conference rooms at places like the Pfister Hotel, a century-old building downtown with a four-story tall atrium lined with marble columns and domed with a glass ceiling. Roughly twice a year, the board gathered for a multi-day strategy session at the Doral Country Club in Miami. The club was later bought by the Trump Organization. So this is where the board would strategize about optimizing Rexnord's strategy and increasing its cash flow, boosting profits, and paying down debt. The part about paying down debt was key. That was key. So this was what made the private equity business something like a self-starting perpetual motion machine. Rexstern employees were working hard to pay down debt that Carlyle used to buy the company. And as they did so, they increased the value of Carlyle's ownership stake by making the debt disappear. If all went smoothly, Carlyle would be able to sell the firm in a matter of years. So, couple things I just want to touch on there. So, again, in corporate America, if you're not familiar, it is very common for when you have strategy meetings, if you're doing strategic planning, if you're doing different things like that, you're usually going to have those meetings offsite. You're not going to have them, like, say, at the corporate headquarters. And a part of the reason is you want privacy. You don't want distractions. You want to be able to work on this stuff without having all the kind of day-to-day things, especially for the CEO, having people, you know, pop in every 5 minutes because they need them to sign this and do that. And what's this? What's that? Another book, a great book called The Five Dysfunctions of a Team by Patrick Lentoni. I think it was Lentoni. But excellent book. I'll do a book review on that one day too. But that's a great book if you ever want to kind of get into a little bit more of a granular understanding of kind of the inner workings of corporate boards. Okay, back to Rexnord. So unfortunately, the Rexnord deal started to go sideways almost immediately. The economy slowed down in 2003, and Carlyle had nearly $1 billion in cash and debt riding on the deal. So when Powell was told that Rexnord was starting to founder, he only had one primary question: what's your plan? Janssen and Hitt spent long days in meetings at the Miami resort hashing one out. During their off hours, the board members and executives played golf. Janssen felt that he really got to know Jay Powell on the golf course. Powell didn't seem to get cocky when his shots were perfect and didn't get bitter when he shanked it. This sounds like a trivial thing, but it was telling. A person can't fake that kind of behavior for hours at a time. It was just like golfing with a buddy, Janssen recalled. Like many people who worked with Powell, Janssen felt a kinship with him. I don't think he's a Midwesterner, Janssen said, but he seemed like it. So I think, again, I think we also get to see here that Jeremy Powell is a nice guy. He's a regular guy. He's an affable guy that's basically able to relate to other people. So, you know, good qualities to have. Janssen took cues from Powell, who didn't panic when the market sank. Rexnord eliminated about 385 jobs from his workforce of 5,285 employees to lower costs and help pay the interest costs of $45 million in 2004. But orders rebounded that year, and with lower overhead, Rexnord's profits jumped. Powell's confidence in the management team had just been justified. But it wasn't enough for Rexford to simply survive from year to year, boosting its sales and cutting costs. That didn't deliver the kind of profits that Carlyle's general partners sought from their investments. Remember, 20% plus return. Private equity firms sought double digits, usually after selling a company within 5 years or so. These were hard numbers to achieve by inventing new products or breaking into new markets. The more common tactic was to take on more debt and buy more companies. This loaded more debt onto the existing firm, but instantly added new product lines and customers while providing a quick way to cut costs when the firms were merged. Tom Honig would have described this as a misallocation of resources. When it's easier to borrow money, companies use the debt for mergers or private equity takeovers. These activities benefit the people with access to capital, but they rarely spark innovation, create new jobs, or give pay raises to working people. Exactly. This is exactly the point. When, you know, debt is cheap and easy, these are the kind of things that are going to go on. This is great for private equity. It's great for hedge fund. It's not great for the little guy that actually works at these companies. You know, I think of the Toys R Us example and how Bain Capital blew up Toys R Us and cost, 30,000 people at Toys R Us their job. And you see here in this example, what happened? They were going to move jobs back to North Carolina or whatever, and they basically made the union guys take a concession. And then things got tough, and what'd they do? They instantly cut 245 jobs. So that's 245 people that lost their job out. And that's the way these companies operate. They don't, they grow the company, but instead of adding new product lines or whatever, they just go out and buy another company and slap it in there and then just cut more jobs and then and create, you know, efficiencies and then just try to bulk it up to sell it to the next guy. Like that's the name of the game here. So as Thomas Haunting said, that this is a misallocation of resources. He's exactly right. When it's easier to borrow money, companies will use that debt for merger or private equity takeovers. These activities benefit the people with access to capital, but they rarely spark innovation, create new jobs, or give pay raises to working people. Exactly the point. In early 2000, now you can understand why the economic recovery from, you know, from 2010 to about 2016 was so anemic, because the people, companies weren't looking to add jobs. They were just adding debt to fuel transactions like this. The jobless recovery. In early 2005, Rexner still carried more than $507 million in debt and paid twice as much money on interest cost than it earned in profit. But Jay Powell and the company's board of directors decided that there was room for Rexner to borrow more. Oh, geez, I'm shocked. A corporate takeover target caught their eye. Of course it did. It was another old line manufacturing firm based in Milwaukee called Falk Corporation. Rexner's executive team engineered a deal to borrow $312 million in the form of a leveraged loan, which was loaded onto Rexner's balance sheet, pushing the company's annual interest payments from $44 million to $62 million. Rexner's total debt jumped from $507 million to $754 million. Still, this acquisition made Rexner more attractive to an outside buyer. The company had diversified its product line, expanded its footprint, and still enjoyed a steady flow of cash from operations. It was time for the Carlyle Group to cash out of its position. First, Rexner toyed with the idea of going public and offering shares for sale on Wall Street. But there wasn't strong enough interest, and Rexford didn't follow through. The real opportunity came in the form of another private equity firm called Apollo Management. Apollo wasn't afraid of Rexnord's heavy debt burden because Apollo believed that Rexnord could borrow even more. It devised a plan to purchase Rexnord just as Carlyle had done by syndicating new leveraged loans and loading them into Rexnord. Apollo's ambition on this front was remarkable. The company raised $1.825 billion, more than twice what Carlyle had paid just 4 years earlier. So you can see how this goes. Remember when we mentioned before about the private equity business, something like a self-starting perpetual motion machine. And now you begin to see like how this just ramps and rolls and rolls and goes from one private equity firm to the next, and they just add more and more debt. It's like a giant snowball. The payoff to Jay Powell and his team was immense. People at Carlyle would talk about the Rexner deal years later. It is difficult to determine just how much profit Powell earned from the sale because Carlyle does not disclose such figures, but Apollo's purchase price was more than $900 million higher than Carlyle's. Under Carlyle's investment rules, 80% of the profits would have gone to the limited partner investors who put up money for the buyouts and 20% to Carlyle. Of the Carlyle money, of that 20%, 45% went to the corporate mothership, as they called it, and 55% would go to Jay Powell's team. So Tom Jansen, Rexner's CFO in Milwaukee, also cashed out with the Apollo deal. The Rexner buyout in 2006 was the kind of deal that changed a person's life. Jeremy Powell's father had been wealthy by most people's standards, owning a house in Chevy Chase, sending his kids to private school, and belonging to a country club. But the kind of wealth that Powell obtained during his career, wealth estimated at between $20 million and $55 million by 2018, put him in a different economic realm. He ended up leaving Carlyle after the Rexner deal. Powell would dabble in private equity on and off for a few years. Then he joined a think tank in Washington, D.C. before he was nominated to be a Fed governor. Rexner itself didn't fare as well. The company Powell left behind was crippled with debt. And again, here's the point. You always get to this point. When you roll up these companies like this, sooner or later, you always hit a wall. It's just a matter of when. And it's kind of like musical chairs. Who's the last guy to get stuck without a chair? Its total debt burden rose from $753 million to $2 billion in 1 year. Its annual interest rate payments rose from $44 million in 2005 to $105 million in 2007. The company would pay more money in interest than it earned in profit every year for more than a decade. Let me say that again. It would pay more money in interest than it earned in profit every year for more than a decade. Rexnord had become a company that was emblematic of the private equity world. It was no longer a company that used debt to pursue its goals. It was now a company whose goal was to service its debt. And this, you see this time and time again. It was no longer a company that used debt to pursue its goals. It was now a company whose goal was to service its debt. So between 2011 and 2020, the debt-heavy world of Rexnord would intersect with the Fed's world of ZIRP. Leveraged loans and corporate bonds were the exclusive tools of a boutique industry when Jay Powell used them to buy Rexnord. The decade of ZIRP would change that. It turned these debt instruments into a retail item sold through emporiums to the investing masses. One of those emporiums was Credit Suisse Bank, which built a thriving division that sold leveraged loans. Rexnord, as heavily indebted as it was, would become a gold mine for the deal makers at Credit Suisse, who underwrote multiple massive debt deals for Rexnord. These transactions were part of a new American economy, powered by the flood of money that the Fed began to release in 2010. One person who helped underwrite and arrange Rexnord's revolving series of loans was named Robert Hetu. He was a managing director of Credit Suisse, who helped underwrite the loans that allowed Apollo Management to buy Rexnord. So Hetu was no stranger to big borrowings. He had seen a lot during his years on Wall Street, but he had never seen anything like the debt markets after quantitative easing began. There was so much cash flowing into the banking system that no one knew what to do with it. But predictably, Credit Suisse and others did figure something out. It was called the CLO assembly line, and it helped create the largest amount of corporate debt in U.S. history. So there you have it, everyone. So that is the end of chapter 8. And I'm now happy to say we are officially halfway through the book. There are 16 chapters in the book, and we are now through 8 chapters. The next chapters should go very quickly. They're kind of shorter, a little bit. They're a little bit shorter, a little bit quicker chapters. So we'll start to move through these next two chapters a lot faster. But I thank you so much for hanging in. I really hope you're enjoying this series. And I hope you will continue to listen through as we finish out the second half of the series, as we get into the remaining chapters. And I will be back real soon with, probably next week, coming back with chapter 9. And then we will take it from there. So, and if, again, as always, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe. It always helps the channel, and it definitely helps this series. So thanks a lot. And I will see everybody again real soon.